This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's Friday. Frida Liu here on Enterprise Biz Bikes together with
Arvini Branj
and Lily. She's there pressing the buttons. This Friday, we're talking about something very serious. I know it's a Friday, but we're talking about data leaks, right? And this is Uber's data leaks and whether this is ethical. And I guess the general conversation about data leaks is going to be the thing for the day. As we are we continue our conversation, you can also let us know your thoughts on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. So as the world grows more connected each day like it's not already, we leave ourselves more exposed to cyber attacks that have compromised data and left people in power embarrassed by the revelations. The latest data leak that made the headlines was from Uber. Mm-hmm. It's revealed a story of denied justice, secretly lobbied governments and violence against their own drivers. So where is the ethical line in the sand drawn when it comes to data leaks, and how does it affect companies when it happens? I was also having a conversation with Matt Armitage about this as well earlier on. So we'll be speaking to Kelly Koh from Surya Project to hear her thoughts a little later. But one of the latest data leaks has revealed some shocking revelations behind a company was that of Uber, and the source has publicly identified himself as Mark McGann, a former lobbyist for the company.
Yeah, so more than 124,000 documents consisting of emails, text messages, memos and other forms of documentation were leaked, dubbed the Uber files, quote-unquote. The investigation covers the ride-hailing company's aggressive expansion into various cities around the world.
So this aggressive approach often pushes the limits of existing laws and regulations. Former CEO Travis Kalanick was implicated in many of the documents in which he has come out to flatly deny any wrongdoing. The material was shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, which took the lead in investigations, and dozens of other news organizations. Journalists from 29 countries helped scrutinize the documents over a period of 4 months.
Mm-hmm. So while Uber users look at Uber as a useful service that brings them from point A to point B, all from the convenience of their smartphones, behind the professional interface of the app, it was alleged some questionable practices took place. So just like breaking those down, investor money was alleged to have been channeled into beating their rivals by manipulating the ride-sharing economy. Lucrative driver subsidies were removed once Uber established itself, and then there was this move undercut the earnings of drivers, many of which bought or leased cars to drive under the company. Uber also temporarily offered massive discounts for their passengers to get them accustomed to their ride services at an artificially suppressed price point. When launching operations in a new city, Uber spent millions in investor capital to entice drivers to its services. The move altered the economic landscape of ride hailing in the cities itself because they became, I think I read somewhere that they used the word invasive species, right, when describing them. In this early phase of expansion, Uber paid out nearly 90% of a driver's hourly earnings, which sent existing taxi drivers into economic hardship. And then as taxi drivers lashed out due to their livelihood shrinking, Uber took advantage of the repercussions against their drivers to win support from regulators and the public. So working behind the scenes, Uber provided details that would shine a negative light on the taxi industry.
Lobbyists were also engaged to highlight attacks against their drivers with intention of pushing for regulatory changes to legalize its operations. In 2016, Uber's budget for policy and communications work stood at $90 million based on a draft of the budget documentation. Out of this figure, 45% went to foreign public affairs work. In some countries where the company operated, despite court orders to desist, UB allegedly had a 24-hour multi-country emergency response system that was used to safeguard company information and to stump authorities in the event of an investigation. The kill switch, as is referred to, was used to cut connections to Uber's internal networks to stop investigations into the company. Legal experts have said these documented actions have raised questions about possible breaches of law pertaining to obstruction of justice in France, the Netherlands, India and Hungary.
Uber's expansion into France specifically has put a spotlight on Emmanuel Macron, who has promised to turn France into a startup nation. So the leaked internal documents from the Uber file suggest that as economy minister, Macron's backing has occasionally conflicted with the policies of the government he served. Executives at Uber believe that Macron was supportive by pushing regulators to be less conservative in their enforcement of the rules that would limit the company's operations. There was also stuff about internal communications also indicated that Uber was surprised by the amount of support by Macron. And while Macron's commitment to Uber's business model was unwavering, some executives concluded that he was not as valuable as an ally as they had thought. Also detailed in the files, Macron had failed to record at least 3 or 4 meetings with Uber's chief executive and founder, Travis Kalanick. In a response to the leaks, the French presidency has issued a statement that the economic and employment policies at that time were well known and that his role naturally led him to meet and interact with various companies as well. The opposition has since called for a parliamentary inquiry into Macron's dealings with Uber.
Devon Spurgeon, a spokeswoman for Travis Kalanick, has come out to say he has never authorized any actions or programs that might obstruct justice. He has also denied authorizing or directing any illegal conduct in Uber's expansion to Russia. So despite what the leaks revealed, Travis has never suggested taking advantage of violence at the expense of Uber driver's safety or accusations that Travis directed, engaged in, or was involved in any of the activities are utterly false. Devon also mentioned the ICIJ has flatly refused to allow requests to review and inspect any of the leaked documents, which raised concerns about the documents' reliability. Regarding the accusations of Uber's use of kill switches or other methods to restrict access to Uber's data in the event of a raid, these systems are common business practice and not designed to obstruct justice. The protocols do not delete data or information, and their use was approved by Uber's legal and regulatory departments. And pertaining to accusations that Travis directed or was aware of violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act or laws that govern Uber's effort to expand to Russia elsewhere, everything was done with clear approval and authorization from Uber's legal team.
Yeah. Uber also released a statement in response to the leak by acknowledging their mistakes prior to 2017. They also pointed out that their CEO, and I'm going to butcher this name definitely, Dara Khosrowshahi, was tasked with transforming every aspect of how Uber operates. He was assisted by Eric Holder, a former U.S. Attorney General hired to investigate and revamp business practices. So in the process, Dara made a few key changes. Most notably, he made safety a top company priority, implemented best-in-class corporate governance, hired an independent board chair, and put in place rigorous controls and compliance necessary to operate as a public entity. It was also pointed out, though, that 90% of current Uber employees joined after Dara became CEO. They ended the statement by saying that we have not and will not make excuses for past behavior that is clearly not in line with our present values. Instead, we ask the public to judge us by what we've done over the last 5 years and what we will do in the years to come.
Right. Okay. So, and I feel that that's the case, right? He's come up. We're not going to make excuses, but there's also they're moving on, right?
New management, right?
New management moving on. They've never denied any of these things, and then I think that's only fair, right? I also wonder though, like a couple of things, right? It's that fine line, and it's about business as well, right? First of all, the information that was leaked, was that right? Right, and of course, you know what lobbyists do. Right? They try to, you know, manipulate and maneuver. That's their job, right? Is lobbying, and there's a lot of back-end work that goes on. I'm not saying I agree or disagree, but this is their work and they're trying to change mindsets, they're trying to change things. I'm thinking like in Malaysia as well, whether that's the case. And maybe because they have done the work that has set the path for the likes of the Grab and the AirAsia and all the other drive apps that have happened because of the work they've done.
I wanted to ask you though, like, does it change your perception when you hear news like this about a company? Of course, we don't have Uber here anymore. Like you mentioned, but let's say we did. Let's say they were still operating here, like locally. Would it change your impression or your usage of them if things like this came out? Like, what does it do to damage their image?
I think, like, for example, that time, you remember, there was all this harassment and, you know, you wonder, like, what concerns me? Like, how are the drivers vetted, right? These are things that concern me. And then secondly, seriously, the price.
Price
factor, right? So unless you have been, like, removed from the market, I think, like, as a user, this doesn't really bother me.
Yeah.
Right? So then, of course, you're like, it doesn't bother me, but it might bother some people. And then, like, you look at then 2 players or 3 players, who is seen more favorably in my eyes and who will be my first preference, right? That sort of thing. But what they did, I don't know if the bigger thing is, like, information that was leaked, whether that was the the right thing in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Also, you mentioned the two or three different players. I think that's the problem if Uber is in countries where they are the monopoly. That's why you can't have monopolies,
you know?
So if they are the only dominant player in that space, then who do you have to choose, right? Like, no matter what comes out about them, the customers don't have a choice at the end of the day.
Right. I'm just looking at this again, right? Investor money was alleged to have been channeled into beating the rivals by manipulating the ride-sharing economy, how they were giving discounts to passengers to their right as an artificially sub. We know that. There was no way when they first came out, it was like 3 ringgit to go somewhere. There was no way.
There was no way.
And you know that wasn't going to be sustained, right? But if you just to get your, what do you call it?
Your buy-in.
Loss leader. That was the thing, right? To be, if you got a couple of players and you want to be a loss leader, this is what the money is doing to try to grab you, try to get you as a customer, right? So this is the business, right? So when I look at some things are just like, it's business. I want to be a loss leader and I'm willing to do that. So I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but also the sometimes this is what you do.
It's a bit grey and where's the line, right?
And so there you go. We'll continue our conversation with an expert, Kelly Koh from Surya Project, to hear her thoughts right after this. Stay tuned to Enterprise Biz Bites, really together with Arvind Yuvaraj, BFM 89.9.
Budding fresh ministers, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's Enterprise Biz Bites. Frida Liu together with Arvind Yuvaraj. We're talking about the recent Uber's data leaks and whether this was ethical. And of course, we know we were giving the backstory to this, what was done behind the scenes. And, you know, Arvind and I were arguing heatedly behind the scenes. So now, differing point of view. But yes, if you have any thoughts around this, Twitter, BFM Radio, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. And of course, we like to hear from an expert. We've got Kelly Koh, right? And Kelly Koh is from...
Program Officer at the Sina Project.
Right. And so we'd like to hear her thoughts around her thoughts around this, right? So, Kelly, can you let us know, what do you make of the latest large-scale leak that has hit Uber?
I see it as a structural problem within the company that enabled all these questionable business practices to happen and continue for a substantial amount of time. An environment that enables the amount of control lies within a few key personnel with little oversight. It is also a good case study to think beyond the usual whistleblowing policy. When you have rich and powerful people, including world leaders across multiple countries involved in alleged wrongdoings, when and how should a whistleblowing be carried out in a manner that carries least harm?
So, Kelly, the leak has revealed quite a bit of questionable business practices perpetrated by Uber. How might these revelations affect Uber as a company?
It leaves a negative public impression that Uber holds questionable values in operating its businesses. These revelations, especially they are now said to have concrete evidence of how the company evaded the law, may cause investors to pull out from the company with the possibility of lawsuits coming their way. Another aspect is the likelihood of tightening of laws regulating the tech giants. Take the kill switch operation, for example. Uber will be seen as exploiting the system, using their technical capabilities as an advantage to evade enforcement. Authorities will not want that to happen again and will try to prevent the tech giants from gaining an upper hand. This may lead to perhaps a data localization, meaning a requirement where local laws may compel companies to keep a copy of data stored within the jurisdiction of national government if they choose to operate in that particular country, as opposed to the freedom to have the data storage at another country with more flexible regulations.
Kelly, as a side note, is it fair to equate the actions of the top executive with the company as a whole?
So here we are looking at two positions taken, one by Uber and the other by the founder Kalanick. Uber is saying, look, we are no longer the same. We are under a new leadership with over 90% new members. They are essentially distancing themselves from the past. Kalanick, on the other hand, is denying all alleged misconduct or illegal conduct. And the work done in the past was a teamwork under the advice of the legal, policy, business development team. To a certain extent, it is a plausible explanation. Because if the allegations were true, all this happened within the control of Kalanick for a substantial amount of time. One or two people were not able to make this happen. in the kill switch operation where they allegedly used a kill switch to disconnect the evidence that enforcement agencies were seeking, it took a team of willing players acting as enablers, holding similar values to make them happen. It needs more convincing from Uber to clear its image, and distancing themselves is simply not enough. Uber will need to show commitment in reforms, especially in protecting its drivers' interests and rights.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's just take a moment to touch on the ethics, right? There are some who justify the leaks by saying that it reveals corrupted and hidden practices that would have otherwise been hidden. What would you say to that?
To decide whether whistleblowing is a correct choice of action will depend on the overall harm or benefit costs or prevented by the information release. It is a proportionality calculation. Organizations usually do not support external whistleblowing because it indicates that there is an internal ethical failure within the organization and that such action is also seen as a betrayal of professional standards. Here we have a situation where leaks are at an international scale involving powerful people from several countries. In this case, a whistleblower will have to go against the ordinarily imposed authority. Whistleblowing at this large scale with international attention offers an additional form of oversight, opening up the possibility to have greater degrees of external examination. There is a public interest to curb abuses of power and wrongdoings. When you have a large scale leak involving high-ranking personnel, there aren't many choice of platforms to hold them accountable but to disclose it through the media. No doubt that there will be a possibility of harm, even though done with good intentions. Then going through trusted media organizations such as ICIJ is the best case option, where there is an expectation that the information on the leaks will be reported on in accordance to journalism ethics and editorial best practices.
Right. You know, in cases such as these, does the law protect whistleblowers when alleged wrongdoings are revealed?
In general, whistleblowers are protected under Whistleblower Protection Act, under Capital Markets and Securities Act in cases of breach of securities law or stocks exchange rules, and similarly under Companies Act for non-compliance. However, these acts are applied when disclosure is made to enforcement agencies and not to the public at large or to the media. In short, if this happens in Malaysia, our existing legislations do not offer protection to a whistleblower who chooses to disclose to someone other than the enforcement agencies. However, there are some jurisdictions that recognize a wider scope of recipients of disclosure. For example, Australia recognizes public interest disclosure or emergency disclosure made to journalists under the Corporations Act 2001.
Right. So with the amount of high-profile individuals involved in all this, how do you see this whole episode panning out in terms of actions and investigations?
ICIJ reviewed many instances of questionable business practices involving high-profile world leaders, but so far they have only disclosed mostly communications and texts among these individuals, while there is still a large amount of data remain undisclosed. This leaves some space for the party's name to work around their responses. It is likely that we will see more PR moves from Uber to drive the narrative that it is a completely different company now, the whistleblower's intention and also focusing on Kalanick's control in the past. It is likely that we will see internal inquiries being carried out first within the institutions before more evidence, paper trails surface or reach the authorities, or witnesses come forward that could lead to formal investigations taking place targeting Uber and the individual's name.
Right. You know, high-profile leaks such as these are becoming more common these days. How might news such as this shape a company's policy when it comes to securing their data?
This will have the effect of revising the access and control of data, the tightening of non-disclosure agreement, and possibly leading to surveillance on employees' activities and communications such as access to work emails and devices. Companies will be putting more considerations into choosing the location of data storage, and the laws and regulations apply at the location of choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last question, Kelly. If an entrepreneur or a business is caught in a situation where data leaks reveal potentially sensitive information, what exactly can they do about it, aside from, you know, like patching up the gap that has allowed for these leaks to happen?
Depending on the nature of data, there are two interests to be balanced. One being the interest of data subjects to be informed as soon as possible about the potential security risk and what can be done to mitigate the risk. The other being limiting the information about security vulnerabilities to the public in order to prevent potential attackers from taking advantage to exploit and further aggravate the problem. A compromise would be to limit the disclosure of the security vulnerabilities to only the people involved in resolving the security vulnerabilities, and with a proper standard operating procedures to decide circumstances where warnings to the data subjects are required and the amount of information to be disclosed.
Right. Thanks. Kelly Cole, Program Officer at CINAR Project, for, you know, shedding some CINAR to this whole topic. And it's, you know, very, again, you know, we've got a comment here from Yao Yang on over WhatsApp. Said, I don't know how you're going to watch corrupted practices in big corporations when the corrupted practices in government is barely monitored. I guess it takes a thief to catch a thief. Yao Yang. Okay, thanks for that comment. You know, so this whole idea, I think it's still... Where do you draw that line, right? And of course, then you're also worried as a corporation, right? What could be misconstrued or what have you? Of course, you always want to do the proper thing. But sometimes it's like, I'm reading some stories. Some seem so far out, but some seems like a marketing strategy or a business strategy, you know, trying to capture market share. I'm looking at it from my lens, lah. You know, some people will look at it differently.
Mm-hmm. And then there are so many people in the company. I know that Kelly mentioned that, you know, it takes a lot of people to make these things happen. But then again, like, you know, you brand a whole company as a bad company and there are so many employees just there doing their job. They're there to make a living. You know, they do their job from 9 to 5, whatever they do, and they're going in, specialists, experts. They all get branded the same way, you know, like one shot when a company goes through something like this. They all get branded as working in a quote-unquote toxic or a company that has questionable practices.
And I'm just looking at the CEO, and I'm assuming it's a new CEO, 19% new staff. And it's like, hi, this comes in before. You know, here I'm trying to move forward and make changes, right? And then this you know, old stuff, you know, resurfaces. And it's not something that, you know, he's done. But anyway, that was our discussion, Uber Leaks. And I think this we're going to see more of these stories moving forward. But then you wouldn't know, Arvin, because
maybe you won't.
Okay, because Arv is on his last show on Enterprise Biz Bites. Fret not, you will still hear him talking about movies and such
and pop TV shows.
On TV shows and pop culture. So, you know, the story Uber comes out in a movie. You'll be reviewing it. Okay.
Yeah,
so anyway, any last words?
Let me just plug TikTok. Follow our TikTok. Follow our TikTok at BFM Radio. That's what I want to say.
Because then you also will see him there. Yes.
Every now and then.
So, but you got to watch that space. So, yeah. Okay. Arv, Enterprise Biz Bikes, you know, so this will be his last show. But again, Popcorn Culture, you can hear him also occasionally, you know, coming out on TikTok. So do follow us there. After the news at 1 p.m., it's the Breakfast Grill replay. And we'll be speaking to Dato' Khalis Rahim, Group Human Capital Officer of Malaysia Airlines, and Professor Dr. Murali Rahman, Deputy Vice Chancellor of the Academic Development and Strategy APU. So in May, the youth unemployment rate for those aged 16 to 24 years is at 12.5%, which is around 341,000 persons, right? So on World Youth Skills Day, Dato' Khalis Rahim and together with Professor Dr. Murali will be talking how we can equip young people with skills employment, the mismatch in the job market, and how can we imagine youth skills beyond formal education. All happening after news at 1. You've been listening to Enterprise Biz Bites. Frida Liu. Bye-bye, Arvin Yuvaraj. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.